You know, some people think that I tell my story to get praise or to, you know, be on the news or be on shows like this. And you don't realize how difficult it is to become so vulnerable and to open your family up to that scrutiny. But I know how important it is, because when a news segment airs, I get hundreds and sometimes thousands of comments and messages and people who are suffering in silence. And they tell me how much inspiration they get. And so I don't want my struggles and everything that I've suffered to be in vain. Like, I really believe that God gives people struggles and trials to overcome them and then to be that hope and help to other people.
And a Safford City Council member is suspending his campaign for Congress.
A Safford City Councilman has suspended his campaign for Congress after suffering a heroin overdose.
His name is Chris Taylor. You may have actually know the name very well. It's been very publicized here in the Arizona media and the Arizona press.
Chris Taylor was running for the Republican nomination to challenge Democrat Tom O'Halloran this November.
And tonight, Chris Taylor says he is seeking treatment for substance abuse.
We first met Chris Taylor in 2017 as we dug in on the opioid problem plaguing the eastern Arizona city of Safford.
In a previous campaign ad, Taylor opened up about his struggles with opioid addiction after two tours in Afghanistan.
Taylor, a veteran who fought off addiction to open his own treatment center, was poised to be the success story for Safford. But he went backwards as old demons resurfaced last week. A relapse that resulted in an overdose. In a statement to suspend his congressional campaign, Taylor was very direct, saying, quote, "I'm not going to hide from this. I'm not ashamed of what happened. I wish to sincerely apologize to the amazing people who have supported me. It's a haunting reminder of a dark past that will always be looking over the shoulder of a bright future."
All right, everybody. Welcome to the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. I'm your host, Chris Taylor. I realized last night my wife and my two children are out of town at the moment for a number of days. And so I've been pretty much recording episodes nonstop so that I can bank some episodes and spend more time with them when they get back on Sunday. And I realized last night, after doing like three episodes, that my catchphrase is welcome, welcome, welcome. I say that like almost every episode. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Come This Far podcast. I didn't realize kind of how stupid it sounds, but now I can't stop saying it. So welcome, welcome, welcome. I guess that's my, that's me, right? No sense in hiding from it. That's just who I am. With all of the historic political news that we've encountered over the last week or two, 3 weeks, I violated my promise not to make political episodes. But I felt like, okay, this is historic. And if I don't talk about this, because I said that I wasn't going to talk about politics, when my kids and grandkids discover these episodes years from now, they're going to wonder why I didn't talk about the second impeachment or the insurrection at the Capitol, the siege, the failed coup attempt. Why did he not talk about it? So that's why I did. And I tried to, you know, not be petty about it. I tried to just be objective. And I think I was. And then I did an episode about sort of how we can actually make America great again, what that really means in my mind, and I think what it means in a lot of people's minds. It was never really explained to us. But today I want to get back to another angle that this podcast has often taken, and that is in the world of addiction, addiction recovery, the world of overdose awareness, the world of being authentic and reaching a point where you have total self-acceptance and where you are accountable for your actions, where you can admit promptly when you're wrong, and where you can continue to evolve and progress and grow as a human being. You know, all of these things that have come to me because of my struggles with addiction. And I've often talked about how grateful I am for those struggles, because without them, I would never, like most people, never be forced into a situation where you have to break down everything about yourself and every stage of life and process traumas that are left unprocessed, and make a searching written moral inventory about yourself on an ongoing basis, so that you can continue to identify your character flaws and fix them and find your shortcomings and your weaknesses and work on them. And so again, I'm grateful for that, and I'm again grateful for the situation that occurred nearly a year ago now. We're in the middle of January, just coming up on 11 months of sobriety since my overdose, my near fatal overdose, and what made me, after several years in sobriety, have to go back to the drawing board and do what I had failed to do the first time, reaching sobriety and being in recovery. And so I'm grateful for it. This has been a difficult week. Started out the week last weekend with some devastating news of a very close friend of mine, one of my oldest friends, more like a brother, actually, a little brother that was best friends with my actual little brother, less than 2 years younger than me. We played on the same high school teams. We grew up playing hours on end at my house with my brother and him. Andrew is his name. He passed away recently, and you know, after struggling from with addiction for many years, and he was one of the people that were there for me in a big way when I was struggling at the beginning of last year. He was one of the people that understood completely and reached out and continued to reach out, and we talked deeply about, you know, our shared trials and struggles. And he had just reached a year of sobriety, over a year of sobriety, and the most time he admitted to me that he's ever had completely sober, other than being, you know, in jail or rehab. And he comes from a very prominent family in our community, very just the best of the best of families. His two parents that are examples of Christ-like love and charity, and they embody so many of the attributes of the Savior Jesus Christ. They are kind and committed and forgiving, and they've raised an amazing family. Andrew has like six sisters, and he's the only boy, and most of all of the girls are older than him, except one, who was the baby, the younger one, and they just adored him. And he had a wife, he has a wife, two young children, twins, a boy and a girl, and then a stepson that he has raised since he was very young. And I believe he's now 16 or 15 or 16 years old. And so it's just, it's mind-numbing. It's heartbreaking. It's devastating. No words can describe how I am feeling because of what I have just experienced over the last year. And now I can kind of see on that other side of it where all the people that reached out to me when they realized that I had nearly died and I survived, and all the people that were there with understanding and forgiveness and love and compassion, all of those same people are suffering right now with the loss of Andrew. Our whole community is in mourning because of such how great of a man he is and was on this earth, and all the good that he's done despite his trials and struggles. People see Andrew for who he really is, and he is an amazing father and husband and community member, coach, mentor, the most kind-hearted, forgiving, understanding, compassionate, empathetic person, soft-spoken, and I'll never forget that little boy that nearly that basically lived at our house, at least in the summer times, every day out there for hours playing basketball with the neighborhood kids, and not even taking a break to eat or drink, just the pure love of the game. And he passed that on to his stepson, to his son, and he's a standout athlete because of the time and effort and work that Andrew put in to him and coaching his teams, and it's just heartbreaking. The community's come together and raised over $30,000 in a number of hours to help this beautiful family get past this difficult period. And and there's just so many different feelings going on in my body at one time. Shock and heartache being the top, but also a flood of wonderful memories, beautiful memories, and also several regrets, and that I wish to talk about today, because like I said a million times, this is a journal for me. This podcast is a diary for me. This podcast is an outlet to where I can think out loud and I can process things in a healthy way. And so I want to take you back. Those of you who listen to this podcast, the third episode of this podcast, way back before I had video, it's called the origins of my addiction and where it began. And so without getting too far into that, if you want to learn about that, go and listen to episode 3 on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or anchor.fm/comethisfar. A number of ways you can listen to that. It's eye-opening. But I was 15 years old, and I was a straight cut kid. I was an Eagle Scout. I was a leader on the basketball and football teams, a standout athlete. I had skills that I worked very, very hard at. Nobody worked harder than me. I shot baskets and played basketball for hours and hours and hours on end to develop a game that I was well on my way. And I did end up getting scholarship offers to sign with the university to play basketball to get my school paid for. And so I had goals and aspirations, and I lost friends who started to even smoke cigarettes and experiment with alcohol, because I had tried that and thought, no, man, this is not for me. I have goals, and my parents were great at talking to me and my brother about the dangers of substances and being dependent on them and developing addictions that no doubt run in our family. The genetic predisposition is 100% present in our family. And so I was against it until one day as a sophomore, I was returning a kickoff in the football game, and I suffered a major injury to my back where I could not move because of the immense pain. I got speared in the back with the helmet, and my spine, it ran down my spine. The lightning felt like a lightning bolt down my legs. If I moved an inch to the left or right, it would shoot down again, like I was getting electrocuted. That's what it felt like. And I wasn't paralyzed, but I couldn't move because I was passing out because of the pain. And they were very worried because they thought maybe I had some internal damage. I could have had a ruptured spleen. I could have had a number of issues. So they rushed me to the hospital. And on the way to the hospital, down this road, if you know anything about Safford, where I live, the high school road is very bumpy, and every time we hit a bump, it would trigger that shock down my leg, and I lost consciousness on the way to the hospital, in and out, because of that pain. And I get to the emergency room, and the nurse they cut my pads off, and the nurse tells me there's going to be a pinprick on the top of your hand, and without thinking anything of it, I said okay. And within an instant, I went from the worst excruciating pain that I've ever felt to the most comforting and euphoric and numbing and warm, heavenly, celestial feeling that I've ever felt in my life. And not only did it take away the pain, but it triggered something inside of me that for once in my life, I can't describe it, but I can only describe it as this. I felt complete. Like I had been missing something for my entire life up to that point. And over the next few days in the hospital, as I was recovering, I knew that that drug that they were giving me was morphine. And I began to obsess about it a little bit, knowing exactly when the nurse was going to come back. I would lie about my pain level after I was starting to recover so that I could maybe get more of it. And I didn't even know what that meant. And when I got out of the hospital, I recovered fully and was right back like nothing had happened. Still the same kid, still against partying and drinking. You would not find me at a party, with the other kids drinking and having fun. I was goal oriented even after that. Until one night, several months later, when we were out hanging out at the hangout spot, and somebody pulled up, a little bit of an older kid pulled up, and I saw all of these peers of mine flock to his truck, and I thought, what in the world is that? What is happening? He's not that popular. What's going on? And I was told that, well, he's selling OxyContin. And I thought, what in the world is that? And somebody described to me that it was like morphine, but it's a pill form, and you snort it and you feel invincible. And that was the first time that I ever even entertained the idea that I could try a drug, like any drug. And I tried it. And that feeling that I had in the hospital several months before, that euphoric feeling, that feeling that I had, that whatever was missing in my life was complete, and I developed an addiction from there. And it wasn't just me. It was every single person on my basketball team, probably 75 to 80% of my football team, every single person that I knew was drinking, was doing pills, was doing cocaine, was smoking marijuana, was doing hallucinogens. It was rampant. It ran rampant. And I still was against all of that other stuff. I didn't drink. I didn't do smoke weed. I didn't do cocaine. I didn't do mushrooms. I didn't do anything. I still had goals and I didn't want to do that. And then I broke, my back injury was lingering. I broke my ankle. I broke my right leg. I played a whole season, two seasons of football at a high level, varsity, starting tailback, with a broken ankle and a fractured leg. And if you don't believe me, go back and ask my coaches. I had a fracture in the shin bone where every game it would swell up to be like a knot like this big sticking out of my leg. And the only way that I could play was the physical therapist that was contracted with the high school had to make this custom hard plastic cast type thing that had a hollow like egg shaped center, and he would wrap it around that part. And so when I would play, that fractured bone would swell up so much that I had to have that hollow egg shape in the middle of that cast, because it would swell up and protrude in that void, in that empty void. And also I had a high ankle sprain, that there was a hairline fracture, but mostly it was damaged ligaments, and which is almost worse because you can't put a cast on it. It's just a lingering. If anybody's had what's called a high ankle sprain, I don't remember what exactly grade it was, but it was the worst kind. It's almost better to have a clean break, because then you can put a cast on it and it heals. With this, it was like, I know there's no cast. Okay, then I'm playing, because I don't want to lose my starting spot. My whole life revolved around athletics and getting my college paid for and having goals. And so it wasn't a party thing for me. There was other people around me that were partying. They were smoking weed and drinking and doing cocaine and all those party drugs and having a great, great time. And that wasn't me. Despite what the outside looking in of people that were around at the time thought, that was not my motivations. That's not me. That wasn't what I was doing. And I was just doing anything possible to keep my spot and play. And I did, and I was still a standout, even with those major injuries, and probably partly because of the opioids that were numbing me through the games, right? Let's just be honest. If not for that, I'd have not accomplished anything in high school, because those injuries were that severe. And so then, you know, into my senior year, we suffered some very traumatic experiences as a class of 2004. We lost two very close friends in a car accident a week before graduation. And I lost my grandmother a few days before that at in her 60s with a terminal illness. And a couple months later, she was gone like that. And I did not know how to deal with it. I had no coping skills. I didn't have good communication. I didn't even know what I was feeling. And that was the first time that I realized that OxyContin that masked my physical pain could mask my emotional pain. And during all of this, I mentioned that I was a leader. There were people that looked to me for whatever reason, kids my age, kids even older than me, my younger brother's group of friends. They saw me as a leader, and it was a lot of burden on my shoulders. Because I wasn't stable or old enough, you know, looking back, it's like, you know, it's not like I was 25 and they were 13. Like, we were all in it together. We all struggled with substances. We all used substances. And so my friend Andrew was in that group, of kids, good kids. That came from great homes, that knew right from wrong, but that for whatever reason
There was a dark cloud hanging over our community, and we, most of us, suffered from addiction, and many of us continued to suffer from addiction here almost 20 years later. And I remember back when I first found out that my brother and his young friends were using that substance. It didn't come from me, but like I said, everybody was using them. They were you could find OxyContin, like you could find a bag of Skittles. Everybody had them, and everybody was selling them, and they were cheap and easy. And our parents gave us allowance, and they didn't know what was happening. And when I found out about it, I was so upset and irate and scolded them. But they knew that I was doing it. So I'm stuck in a situation where do as I say, not as I do. And I harbored a lot of guilt for that over the years. Like, you know, if I could have figured my stuff out, maybe they wouldn't have gone down that path. So what I'm guilty of in my mind is being a bad example. I didn't start anybody on drugs, but I was doing them. My friends were doing them. So of course, other people around are going to be doing them. And my words were empty when I tried to stop them from doing it. But now, as a 34-year-old man, grown man, a combat veteran, a father, a husband, somebody that has overcome a lot of pain and struggle in my life, I realize that, you know, as much guilt as I can feel when one of my friends that were there in the beginning with me die, we were all kids. And it would be different if I was 20 and they were 13. But I was 16 and they were 15. I was 16 and they were 14. I was 17 and they were 15 and 16. And looking back as a 34-year-old, that's all the same. And I don't know why I was seen and still am seen as this leader that led people astray. Why did I have that burden when everybody around me was using all kinds of drugs to have fun? I wasn't. I was suffering from an addiction to an opioid pain medication that was unethically brought to the market by a horrible, evil company that now, 20 years later, is paying the grave price for, and billions of dollars in fines and bankruptcies and everything else for pushing OxyContin onto all of the doctors to say that it wasn't addictive, to give kickbacks to doctors for prescribing. All of these people had a fortune in their pocket. If they went to the doctor and said, I have a backache, here is tons of OxyContin, and you can sell them for $1 a milligram. And in a community of well-off, some middle-class, well-off families, you're going to sell hundreds of thousands of dollars worth. And it's painful to lose friends, especially when they, I know that they have found long-term recovery, and I know that they found peace, and I know that they found healing. And so what this video or what this episode really is about is what I call the second great denial. Everybody knows about denial and how it's a major issue with early in addiction. Nobody can recover initially from an addiction if they don't truly get to that point in their mind where 100% they know that they are an addict and the substance that they are using is has overcome their life and it is unmanageable and I need help and I'm being honest and open and I'm not in denial that I need help. Then and only then can people then work the steps, the next 11 steps in finding healing and finding long-term recovery. That denial early on, that first step, admitting to yourself that you are out of control, that you cannot control this, that you cannot beat this on your own, that you can't, you need help, and you're going to abandon your will and just allow people to help you. That's half the battle, if not more than half the battle in the early on when you're first getting recovery and sobriety. But what in my mind is the worse and more dangerous and often more fatal form of denial is the second great denial. When I come back from this short break, I will break it down. Thank you for listening to the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. I'll be right back. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. Today, we're going back down the path of addiction, addiction recovery. We're talking right now about denial and how we all know about the first stage of denial in addiction when you're early on. Oftentimes, in my case, it was when I was 16, 17 years old when I really realized that I was an addict and that I could admit that I was an addict and that I needed some sort of help. A lot of people take years and years and years and they just never get to that point where they can admit to themselves and to God and to another person that they need help and that they're an addict and that their lives are out of control. And it's not until then, and a lot of people say those words. A lot of people enter treatment. A lot of people do things that seems like they understand. But in reality, there's a part of their brain and a part of their pride or whatever it is that they do not believe in that 100%. And that small reservation, that could be a small fraction of their will, they're holding on to it and saying, I'm not weak. I can beat this. I don't need this. I'm doing this for, my parents are on my back or my wife says she's going to leave me, or my job said they're going to fire me, or, you know, whatever it is, right? But it's when you get to that point in your mind, 100%, I need help, and I'm going to do everything I can to find that help and get that help and find that healing and get into recovery and build experience, strength and hope, and get tools in my toolkit to deal with life and deal with my issues, to tackle my underlying issues of why I need to self-medicate, right? Then and only then can you achieve that early sobriety and that getting on solid ground and going. And in my case, and in many other people's case, you've seen that in your loved one. You've seen that maybe in yourself. You've seen that in a spouse. You've seen that in a parent where man, they seems like they've got it figured out. Finally, they've gotten some help. They're going on the right path. They just look so good, right? When you are addicted to substance, and I use opioids because that's my experience. When you use heroin or other opioids, it takes your soul away within days, and people, your loved ones, can see that. You know, they know something is wrong. They know when you've relapsed. They know when you're down that relapse behavior path, even before you might relapse, because you can see it in their countenance. You can see it in their body movement. You can see it in their eyes. You can see it in the way they talk. You can, and I'm talking about me, right? And but I know how to tell this in other people too, especially friends that I've grown up with. But when you decide to pull back and get into a program or start being in recovery again, that clarity comes back sometimes instantly, sometimes within a few days, even a few hours. That's why you always hear, family members who deal with someone who has dealt with addiction, right? You hear people say often, man, you know, I saw the real Chris was back. Looks like he's just doing so great. Look, you know, you can just tell. And that's because your soul returns, right? It's not numbed anymore. You're able to have that clarity of mind, and you're able, you know, to build on your sobriety and recovery. And you have to do, like I've learned in my life, it's a daily battle that you have to take up every day and fight every day. And the longer you the more you do that days in put together, the stronger you get, the more solid ground you get, the more you go. But very common is the second form, the second stage of denial. The second great denial is the way that I look at it and the way that I label it. And that is where, and in my mind, it's more dangerous and it's more fatal. And there's a reason why. If you think back of all the people that you know that have overdosed and have died, it's always the same thing. Man, they were doing so great. They just celebrated 2 years or a year of sobriety, or 7 years of sobriety, or 10 years of sobriety, or 10 months, whatever it is. They've put together lots of days in sobriety, and they've achieved all of the good things again. They rise in their jobs. They become great family members and great citizens and taxpayers and parents, you know, and spouses. They're back. The person you know and love is back. And it comes quickly, because when you abstain from that, those substances that dull your spirit and take your soul away, your soul wants to come back. And a lot of the times it happens very quickly, and you get that clarity, right? But when that second stage of denial comes, like a brick coming through your windshield at 100 miles an hour, where you get to the point where, man, I've beat this. In my case, it was, I've experienced miraculous healing for my issues, for my addiction, through the grace of my Savior Jesus Christ. My life is just completely different, a complete 180. I met my wife, started a family, started a nonprofit organization, became a city council member, became a firefighter, became a rising star in the Republican Party, and was on my way down a clear path to becoming a member of the House of Representatives, a congressman at 33 years of age. My life was completely different from when I was rock bottom, barely surviving, not having any direction, being just in my life in shambles. And you get to that point where that addiction that used to rule your life, that used to control every waking moment, it feels like it's non-existent, because you've removed yourself so far from those circumstances. When I would tell my story about, you know, my experiences with recovery and getting to where I was before I had my overdose or relapse and overdose, it felt like I was telling somebody else's story, because I was so disconnected from it, because my life was so different, so much better. And it's human nature to want to say, I beat that. I triumphed over that. I overcame that battle. Now I can take on bigger and better things. And I can accomplish all the things that I've ever wanted to accomplish because I've beat that. And once I beat that, I can overcome anything. And you really can. But that second stage of denial creeps in, and it's just that. The words. I can't remember how many times I said it. I said it in my campaign launch video that went viral, that over 100,000 people viewed it in the state of Arizona within a couple of days. I talked about my struggle with addiction and post-traumatic stress, and I say in that ad, I won my battle. Because I had won my battle many times over. But what I should have said is, I'm winning my battle. I'm fighting every day and I'm winning. But I know that the second that I believe that I have won and I can bring my troops home and I don't have to fight that battle anymore and I can focus on other things and completely abandon that, that's the second stage of denial that is even more fatal and dangerous than the first stage of denial, back way back before in your early stages of addiction. And that is why when you hear of somebody that's overdosed and died, and keep in mind, by the way, that we don't really actually know if that is how my friend passed away. So I know everybody's speculating, and it's probably a good speculation, but I mean no disrespect in that speculation. This video, I've loosely talking about him because he's on my mind heavy, and he's my friend. But really, I'm talking to you people who may be struggling, who may have overcome an addiction, who may have but have fallen back, and you wonder why that is. That second stage of denial has taken more of my friends than any enemy I've ever fought. And it almost took me. It did take me. Not for my wife and those paramedics that were heroic and that saved my life. I would be dead. And there's even more to that story that I haven't really talked about, is that at that stage of my relapse, I had gotten to the point where, man, I'm only using every day to not be sick. And so I'm maintaining. Those of you who suffer from heroin addiction know what I'm talking about. Not a party. It's not a fun and games. It's not even getting high. You don't even get high anymore. You just feel normal. You use to feel normal and not to be sick. And so I had already used my daily dose that day from my newest relapse, that I was stuck in this cycle of several weeks of being back in this cycle and stuck in that horrible place where I can't come out publicly and say that I need help. I can't admit to anybody that I need help because it's just way too much on my shoulders. I mean too much to people, my family, my supporters, my community, who sees me as an inspiration and a success story. All of the people who still come to me anonymously for advice and help with their addictions and their kids' addictions. And what are they going to think if I come out and say I relapsed, actually, I need to get help for myself. So it was an unreasonable burden that I placed on myself. But also it was the stigma that's associated, right? And that together was crippling, and I couldn't get help. And so that night I had already done my daily dose. I was not withdrawing. I was not sick. I had one more dose of heroin left. And my plan that I already made was that this is it. I can't do this. And I know that you say that every time. I say that every time, that this is the last time I can't. This is the last time I'm going to use heroin. I'm not going to do it anymore. And then you buy more, right? The next day, your addiction overrules you. But I had reached a point where, look, I'm spiraling out of control very fast. And this is it. I just can't do this. Every part of me wanted to throw that last dose away. But I've never been able to do that. And so I resolved the fact that, okay, I will use this last shot tomorrow. I will go in my truck somewhere kind of far away, maybe up the mountain, maybe in my storage unit, maybe somewhere else, just away from my family. Take that last dose and be done with it. And I put my daughter to bed, and something just controlled me to where I said, just get it over with. Just do this last bit of heroin. Have a great night's sleep, because you're not going to be sleeping again for anytime soon, because I can't sleep very good anyway. And especially when I'm, you know, withdrawing and trying to get clean again, don't sleep. And so it's like, all right, let's do one last shot, have a great night's sleep. But I kept saying, no, I don't want to do this tonight. I've already done some today. I'm not going to get high anyway. I'll just do it tomorrow. And if I would have done that, then I would have been alone. And there's no doubt in my mind that I would not be here today. And something overpowered me and said, you're going to go do that right now. And because I did that, my wife was home. She had just got home from work. It was 10:15, 10:30 p.m. The kids had just got put to sleep. If I would have waited even 30 minutes later, my wife would have been asleep. And she wouldn't have heard me in the bathroom. And she would have woke up the next day, and I would have been old and gray and dead. And so something overpowered me that night, and I'm grateful that it did, because I'm alive today. I'm talking about this because it's important for us that struggle, and all of us struggle. I don't care if you identify as an addict or you just identify as a human being, because if you have a heartbeat and you have a soul and you breathe the air that we all breathe, you have major struggles in your life too. And you can tell, you can continue to pretend like you don't have problems, and all of us have major problems, and we're horrible people because we suffer from addiction. You can tell yourself that all day, but none of us believe it. We all know that we're all struggling. We all fight daily battles, large and small, and we're all overwhelmed, and we all need help. Voicing these struggles and these thoughts that I'm wrestling with, thinking out loud, talking about things to process them, taking accountability, all of that stuff, it's important to provide that example to other people. Because if anything is hidden, it cannot be healed. So I bring my struggles out in the open to talk about them, not to get praise, not to get sympathy, not to be patted on the back, but because this is life and death for most of us, for many of us. It might be a substance that you struggle with. It might be depression that you struggle with. It might be suicidal thoughts that you struggle with. It might be same-sex attraction that you struggle with. It might be a broken-down marriage that you struggle with. It may be a complete lack of feeling and connection that you're dealing with, that you can't feel connected to anything or anyone, that you can't experience joy, that you are depressed, that you think about taking your own life, and that you have attempted to take your own life. We need to stop pretending that any of us don't have problems. And we don't have to keep up appearances. We don't have to people please. We don't have to prove things to people. I'm done with all of that. I don't care what you think of me. I don't care about your judgments. I don't care about your hatred. I don't care about your evilness. I care about my family. I care about my life. I care about becoming a better person every day so that I can raise my children righteously and so that I can teach them exactly how to overcome the trials that they will undoubtedly have. So that I can be that example to them that I wasn't able to be as a 16-year-old to my slightly younger friends. If I could go back and I had the same mindset and same maturity I have now, I would do everything possible to stop all of my friends, all of my basketball teammates, all of my football teammates from going down this path. It's painful. Painful to go to another funeral. But I know that I have been forgiven of those weaknesses. And I know that I'm not accountable for anybody else but myself, especially as a kid. Doesn't mean that I don't regret things. Doesn't mean that I don't have pain about it. The memory of our friends hush
Trooper, no
in the memory of our friends that have passed away. Let's not fall victim to that second great denial, that second great stage of denial. And we all fall victim to it, whether you identify as an addict or not. Let's talk openly and honestly about where we are in life, our fears, our apprehensions, our insecurities, our struggles, our sicknesses, our afflictions, our depressions. If they're in the open, if they're in the daylight, then we can tackle them and we can overcome them with the help of each other. Let's be done with the judgments. Let's be done with the blaming people. Let's be done with hatefulness. And let's just all admit that we're on the same level. We're on the same path. We're on the same road in life. Some of us may be a little bit farther down the road. Some of us may be on the sidewalk. Some of us may be driving the wrong direction. But dang it, we are all on the same road. When you're out on the road driving, do you only look out for yourself? Do you only care about yourself? Or are you cognizant of other drivers on the road? Do you let that person in that's had their turning signal on for a mile? Or do you just keep going so and screw them, right? Do you drive a very nice car and you look at some broken down truck and say, ah, screw that guy. I'm not letting him in my lane. Look at him. He's dirty. He's a loser. Are you adding to the stigma that makes it impossible for people who have had a long and public battle with addiction and finally have reached some long-term sobriety and then they struggle again? And they feel stuck because of the judgments that will come down on them when somebody finds out that they've taken a step back, or they blew out a tire, or they forgot to change their oil, and so they're on the side of the freeway in the cold. Are you going to continue to drive by and flip them off? Are you going to pull behind them with a blanket and a jacket and help them change that tire? Because that, my friends, is the only reason that I do this podcast, that I talk about my struggles and my experiences. And if you think there's any other motivation than that, you don't know me. You've never known me. And I don't care if you know me or not. I don't need you in my life. Those people around me, those people who are kind to me, those people who reach out to me on a daily basis and check on me, and those people that I do the same in return. Those are the only people that I have time for in my life. And those are the only people that I listen to. I don't even hear your hatefulness. Let's progress. Let's grow. Let's learn from each other. Let's be kind and considerate and loving, and let's help each other. And let's abandon all of our inclinations to pretend that everything in our lives is perfect, because we all know that it's not. I don't know how Andrew died. I do know how I almost died. I do know how too many friends to count have died. This is a scourge of our generation. This is the great evil. This is the great cloud that is taking soul after soul after soul. What are we going to do to stop it? Get involved. We're planning great things with the Substance Abuse Coalition. I guarantee you, wherever you live, there's a substance abuse coalition in your county, in your city, in your state. Reach out and get involved. The more people that are there with understanding, and they're there to volunteer, and there to raise money, and they're there for the charitable organizations, who are there to talk and inspire people with your words of encouragement and your experiences and your hope and strength. Tell your story. We all need to hear it. And those of us who matter and who love you won't judge you. You won't be weak. You'll be strong for experiencing that vulnerability, regardless of the scrutiny that it brings. Because that part's not fun. Ask my wife. But this is life and death, and it's important. I love you, Andrew. And this is in memory of you, brother. And I will double and triple and quadruple down my efforts to fight this battle personally, and to help as many people as I can overcome this struggle. Thank you for listening to the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor.